Mr. Goldsmith?
May it please the court, my name is Willis Goldsmith, counsel for the petitioner in this matter. The basic facts are clear. The Occupational Safety and Health Review Commission took 16 and a half years to adjudicate this matter. The case sat fully briefed before the Review Commission for 12 and a half years. As a result of that, the order that the Commission seeks to have this court enforce is an order that directs Dayton Tire, a non-existent entity at this point, to develop lockout tagout procedures.
So Dayton Tire doesn't exist in any form. Dayton Tire is not making tires anymore.
Dayton Tire has not made tires since 2006.
Yeah, Bridgestone still does, obviously.
Bridgestone, the corporation, is still in
these machines that were the subject of the inquiry. Where are they?
Where are the machines that were in the Dayton Tire building?
Yeah.
I assume they were disassembled and
Bridgestone isn't using them in some other plant or anything.
Bridgestone is not using those machines in any other plant. Bridgestone is using machines that over time have evolved that build products in the same way, but they are not using those machines in any other plant. So we have lockout tagout procedures that are, by this order that the Commission seeks to have this court enforce, designed to work and be effective on non-existent equipment in a non-existent facility for non-existent employees. This citation went only to that physical location in Oklahoma City and only to those machines, and the only people who were affected by the supposed violations.
Well, there's a general deterrent effect of OSHA penalties, though, isn't there? I mean, Jackson Shipyards tells us that you can do that, right?
Jackson Shipyard. Well,
obviously, there's no deterrent effect for Dayton. Dayton's gone, but isn't there a general deterrent effect for other employers?
Well, there needs to be the question asked about deterring whom. And to answer that question, one needs to look at how this case arose. Mm-hmm. This case was the only case in the history of this statute, frankly, I think probably in the history of the Department of Labor under any statute, where the Secretary of Labor personally, by himself, accompanied by scores of reporters and photographers, personally served this citation on the Oklahoma City plant. That was the deterrent effect right there. Secondly, deter Bridgestone Firestone. The government can't have it both ways. The commission has written in its decision that one of the distinctions between Bridgestone Firestone, now called Bridgestone Americas at the corporate level, and Dayton Tire was that the corporate level people did all the right things.
But there are other manufacturers of tires, right? It's not, even if Bridgestone's a model citizen, there are others who are watching, right? And there's a deterrent effect to them.
I don't think that any employer in any industry, including in the tire industry, could reasonably assume that, or the government could reasonably assume that employer would be deterred by penalties that were rendered 16 and a half years after a case was first begun. This case is history. Nobody knows about this case. The commission went to great lengths to disguise the fact that the case was pending for 16 years. They don't even refer to the date that the trial started, the date that briefs were filed, or anything else. The only dates they refer to from time to time.
So when did the case become so prolonged that it could no longer be pursued?
Well, we're not arguing for any bright line kind of
right. Review. So that's a problem because how are we supposed to know? We're supposed to just set out some rule. We don't know how long is too long, but this is too long.
No, I think that Judge, with all due respect, you're to look at the actual facts here and what happened.
I know, but we're going to be setting a rule that applies to other cases, and if we're going to do this in a principled way, as opposed to just this has an odor about it. We have to have some principle underlying this, and I'm not sure where the principle comes from or even what you're asking for in terms of that principle. The APA doesn't have a rule that says when this agency decide within 6 years or it's too long.
Well, the APA has a rule, though, in Section 555 that says that agencies are to act within a reasonable time, which is necessarily a question of fact. And the courts that have looked at this in the context, for example, of the National Labor Relations Act have found that 6 years is too long, depending on circumstances. In the TNS case, it was 17 years, although that case had come to this court once in the process. Mm-hmm. So the cases are looked at on a case-by-case, fact-by-fact basis. And what's interesting and I think important is that in the NLRA cases, for example, there were actually employees who were potentially affected by the delay and by the court's decisions in the Second Circuit in Emhart and in the Sixth Circuit in TNS to find that the agency waited too long to act. Here, nobody's affected by this. Nobody's affected by this. In terms of whether there is a bright line, there is no bright line. One does have to look at the facts. All of these cases, all of the willful cases, all of the cases that apply the facts of any particular standard to the facts of a workplace depend very explicitly and intensively.
Isn't one of the factors we're supposed to look at in deciding whether to set this aside is whether it has any continuing deterrent effect? That's one thing, right? But you're suggesting that the deterrent effect was accomplished at the press conference.
In terms of deterring Bridgestone, Firestone, yes. In terms of deterring...
I'm talking about general deterrent effect for other manufacturers.
The general deterrent effect at that point, remember, this was a standard that was promulgated in 1989. It's one of the most complex standards that the government enforces. It's one of the most frequently cited standards. So the deterrent effect was, if you don't comply with this standard, the Secretary of Labor is going to show up at your door and serve this massive citation, and he's going to bring with him photographers, reporters, and then he's going to hold a press conference. And at that press conference, he is going to basically make up the facts.
And they're going to then seek penalties.
And we are that's correct.
That's part of it too.
That's correct. But those penalties.
I don't see much to your argument of because there was a press conference, we should be reluctant to affirm the penalties. That doesn't do much for me, at least.
Well, I'm not trying to make that connection. I was trying to respond to Judge Griffith on the deterrent effect. There's no deterrent effect at this point, paying penalties 16 and a half years after
that. Well, 1.7, I'm sorry.
It's close to $2 million, $1.9 million. $1.9 million.
Lots of places, that's real money.
And it is real money to Bridgestone Americas and to Dayton Tire, and that's why we're here. And we're here in part also because the ALJ, who actually heard this case and sat through 35 days of trial, reduced that penalty. The original penalty was $7 million to $518,000.
Now, on the delay, what about the fact that the agency was stalemated because of confirmation issues for years and years? So the way your brief portrays it, they were just all sitting around doing nothing, but that's not quite an accurate portrayal.
Well, I think it is accurate. First of all, the agency had options. The agency at any time could have dismissed the petition for review. Mm-hmm. This agency monitors how long cases are before it. They publish it every year. I don't know when they knew it was unreasonable, but after 2 years, 4 years, 7 years, 10 years, somewhere along the line, somebody there must have said, maybe we should dismiss the petition.
And you should have thought it's unreasonable.
We did think it was unreasonable.
And you could have brought a mandamus petition.
The business of Dayton Tire, Your Honor, is to build tires. Dayton Tire built 35,000
tires. Well, you have a lot of lawyers, too.
Well, they have a lot of lawyers, as does the Department of Labor. The Department of Labor...
The point being, this idea of there is an action in this court, as you're well aware, where absolutely you can bring an action to compel agency action unreasonably withheld. And we have been aggressive, I think, about doing that when it reaches a certain point of delay. And you didn't bring any such action in this case.
We did not, Your Honor. We substantially prevailed, certainly on the penalty point. Mm-hmm. We had no reason to believe that the Occupational Safety and Health Review Commission would either sit and do nothing for 12 and a half years or not dismiss the petition for discretionary review or not remand it to the ALJ before he retired 4 years.
What I'm getting at is the delay was good for you while it was ongoing, right?
Well, it was good in the sense that we didn't have to pay the penalty, Your Honor, but it was not good in the sense that we had other tire building facilities, as Judge Griffith pointed out. We did not know what the government's position was with respect generally to the application of that standard. We did not know what the government's position would be with respect to the egregious policy under that statute. We did not know what the resolution of our objections to the standard in that case would be. So we were completely in the dark, really, as to the government's position. And the government did nothing. The secretary did nothing. The secretary herself, in the papers here, describes the delay of the commission as inexcusable, as deplorable, and other adverbs like that. And yet the secretary, who is charged with enforcing the statute, did absolutely nothing. The secretary could have brought a mandamus action as well. The secretary goes to great lengths also in the papers to separate herself from the review commission.
Now, what you have an argument completely independent on the merits, obviously. That,
right.
Can you address? Well, I want you to address the merits as well. So, why don't you?
Thank you.
Tell us why the commission is wrong
on
that.
On the willful issue, this court has addressed the question of what willful means under the Occupational Safety and Health Act any number of times. And at bottom, it's that a company cannot be found to have willfully violated the standard if it exhibited a good faith, reasonable belief that it was complying with the statute. Now, that is, as everything is under the statute, an intensely fact-dependent assessment. This is a complicated facility. The Dayton Tire facility was a complicated facility, 72 acres under one roof, 1,200 employees work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and put out 35,000 automobile and light truck tires every single day. The lockout-tagout standard, that, as I indicated, also extremely complicated. It was also very unique because at the Dayton Tire facility, from the day that plant opened in 1969 until the day it closed in 2006, they used a contractor to do all of the maintenance on its equipment. That contractor employed well over 100 people, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The standard goes to maintenance. And it's complicated to determine who is engaged in maintenance because there are certain kinds of maintenance functions that are completely excluded from the coverage of the standard. Our position was, throughout that period beginning in 1969 and was at trial, that the Dayton Tire employees were essentially production employees. They built tires. They did have some minor maintenance functions. Those minor functions were, by the terms of the standard, exempted from training people to a higher level, the level that the Department of Labor says they should have been trained to. There were any number of communications from the corporate safety people to the safety people at Dayton Tire at the division about compliance with the lockout-tagout standard. There were memos, there were conferences, and the decision was made, rightly or wrongly, that we believe that because our people are engaged in production and to the extent that they do maintenance, it's minor maintenance, it's exempt from the coverage of the standard. And I say rightly or wrongly because every OSHA case comes to the commission and comes to this court if it gets here because there was a disagreement between the employer that was cited and between and the Department of Labor. That's what we had here. The secretary's argument on willfulness is a little bit difficult to follow. Basically, she raises 4 points. One, in the brief, she cites to the commission's decision as evidence of willfulness. Of course, the commission's decision cites to nothing. It was a 6,500-page transcript, hundreds of exhibits. The commission cites to nothing. That's one argument. Because the commission found it willful, this court should affirm that finding. They cite to examples in the preamble of the standard that, as our brief points out, bear no relationship to what the operations at that facility were. Again, one needs a very fact-intensive assessment of this. Of course, they cite the commission decisions that were decided long after this case was tried, but perhaps the most telling point is that they cite to and place great weight on, if I may look at this, just read 3 lines or so from the appendix here, on a compliance officer who testified in the lockout-tagout case. This was a compliance officer who did not do the inspection. This was a compliance officer who had done an earlier inspection that resulted in a massive citation that was dismissed in its entirety after trial and the government didn't appeal. This was the person who testified and on whom the government relies for lockout-tagout expertise. Her boss, the area director, testifying about her, says, Mr. McCowan, that's the guy who actually did the inspection and who the government did not call to testify at this trial. 35 days and never called him. Mr. McCowan said Mr. White, the area director, had a lot of experience in lockout, tagout, and had a large General Motors case, actually in Oklahoma City. And I was just knowing that we potentially had a violation of a specific OSHA standard, knowing that the violation potentially could be characterized as willful. I immediately thought if there's a fatality here, and ultimately there was, the criminal sanctions may be in order. And here's what he said about the compliance officer on whom the government now relies. I was not comfortable with the level of expertise of a trainee industrial hygienist and a journey-level industrial hygienist that doesn't normally look at mechanics things. This was an untrained, unsophisticated, unhelpful compliance officer, and that's what the administrative law judge found. I exceeded.
Can I ask a question? Just a question. Should we make anything of the fact that the commission is coming to different conclusions than the ALJ 12 years after the fact? That doesn't play. We're not talking about credibility determinations that require somebody seeing someone, right?
Well, we are, and our brief addresses that, Judge. The government kind of dismisses the ALJ's finding, saying that obviously, and I can't pull up the exact quote from their brief, but the ALJ, who sat there for 35 days and who concluded in his decision as to this particular witness that she was unhelpful, not specific, and doesn't add very much, to me, that's a credibility finding. And that's a credibility finding that the commission reversed without citation to the record.
But the fact that it was 12 years later is irrelevant, though. That's not really important.
No, the fact that it was 12 and a half years later is not relevant, correct.
Thank you.
I've used all my time. If I may have an opportunity for, I had asked for five
we'll
minutes.
Back
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Gary Stearman on behalf of the Secretary of Labor. If this court affirms the decision below, the Daily Labor Reporter will have an article about the case, and it will indicate that a $1.975 million fine was issued and assessed against Dayton Tire. Employers read the Daily Labor Reporter, they read the case law, the lawyers for these companies will tell the employers, and there will be a deterrent value, a general deterrent value on all employers in the United States.
Well, but that could always happen, couldn't it? I mean, it could always be reported in the paper. So even if it was 30 or 40 years later, would we still be arguing that we nevertheless ought to enforce this penalty and because it'll have a deterrent effect?
Well, yes, Your Honor. And I would say that's because the system that Congress has set up is to effectuate the OSHA Act is through civil penalties and through abatement. And the civil penalties provide the deterrence, the pocketbook deterrence value, that will tell employers to voluntarily comply, because OSHA does not have.
And if we went the other direction, what message, what would be the deterrent effect sent maybe to OSHA?
Your Honor, let me clearly distinguish between OSHA and the OSHRC, the Occupational Safety and Health Review Commission. The two entities are different. OSHA is blameless here. We timely investigated. We timely issued the
good
citation.
Good point, well taken. But you get my point. If we went the other direction, what's the message that would be sent to the government here?
Well, the message sent to the OSHRC would be no doubt to may issue more timely decisions, but that may not necessarily be the case, because what the court would be telling the commissioners is if they disagree, the recalcitrant commissioner would just sit on his or her hands and not decide the case. And that would actually cause greater delay, because the recalcitrant commissioner would then not have to decide, would wait for the courts to simply set the decision aside.
But what about the reasonable time standard. Yeah, the agency has to act within a reasonable time.
Well, there's no provision in the APA for a particular time, and there's nothing under the OSH Act that requires the OSHRC to issue a decision at any point in time. But the question is the remedy, I think, for the violation.
Well, the remedy would be you can't act on the particular matter if the agency sat on its hands for so long. And I understand the agency, the commission, may not even be blameless because Congress, through the confirmation process and otherwise, set up a dysfunctional agency. But that's still something that the APA says you have to act within a reasonable time, and if Congress set up something that can't act within a reasonable time, well, Congress has to fix that.
Congress has to fix that. And in any particular case.
But in the meantime, why should we allow agencies to take what you yourself acknowledge is deplorable amount of time?
The APA provides for a mandamus action. That's the answer. Mm-hmm. And certainly Dayton Tire could have asked the court to have to compel the agency or the commission to decide. Its suggestion that the secretary should is really pretty unseemly, because what they're suggesting is that one federal government agency petition the court for another federal agency to act. I think that's really exceptional.
We've had that.
Well, that's pretty
recently.
Exceptional. And the other point I want to make about that, Your Honor, is the secretary did not agree with the factual findings of the ALJ. And if we had moved to compel the commission to decide, one very likely result would have been it would have withdrawn the petition for review and thereby affirmed the ALJ's factual findings. Now, the ALJ found 36 willful violations, but we alleged 100. And so we believed the factual determinations of the ALJ were incorrect, and we wanted de novo review.
On that point, the term willfulness, as I understand it, as the case law explicates, it requires you to violate a known legal duty. You know what the law is, and you say, we're going to violate it anyway. And that's hard to say that willfulness is satisfied when there's ambiguity in the law, or at least some reasonable debate about what the scope of the law is as to a particular set of facts, no?
That's a correct assessment or description of the law. But in this case, what the commission found was that Dayton Tire did not have a good faith belief in their interpretation of the law. What the commission found was as a result of the five events that put Kelly Maddox on notice, that Dayton Tire was in violation of the law, and that she was told to re-examine the law,
looked at the law and came to the same conclusion as to these. And part of this is that isn't it part of it that the regulation is a little hard to follow?
I don't think if you try to read Dayton Tire's interpretation of the regulation, you get hopelessly confused. And that's one of the reasons why the commission found the violation willful, is because their interpretation is plainly erroneous. Now, if you like, I can go through it.
Yes, please.
Okay. The standard covers the servicing and maintenance activities when there's
unexpected. Servicing and maintenance as a general proposition here was done by the contractor.
As a general proposition, yes, but
and that's a key fact that informed both Maddox and McGowan, correct?
But you have to look at how the standard defines servicing and maintenance. Mm-hmm. One of the activities, specific activities, is setting up. Mm-hmm. And there's no dispute that at least three of the activities that were performed in Dayton at the factory, changing the molds in the curing press, changing the bead winder, and setting up the tire assembly machines, the TAMs. Those
are
all setting up.
Where are you in the reg now?
Okay, I'm at section 3, B, Section 3B, which is the definitions.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got setting up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, which is right after servicing and maintenance. And setting up provides any work performed to prepare a machine to perform its normal production operation. So you're just setting the machine up. It can't fall within the minor servicing normal production operations exception, because setting up precedes normal production operations. There's no confusion there. And then when you get to the other activities that are performed during the production operation, the minor servicing exception, which is found at A2II, and you go down to the note.
Well, can I just ask, where are you going back when you, I just want to make sure I'm connecting everything here. When you say, you gave it the definition of setup, but then setup is referred to in the rule.
Under servicing, it's one of the specified activities of servicing and maintenance.
Right. Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt.
You have to look at these definitions.
I mean, I did.
I know you are, but you wonder whether Date and Tire did, Your Honor. Okay.
Well, so. I don't know. Clearly, the record shows there's a lot of time and discussion about this. It's not as if, which you see, I'm sure you see, with some companies that just ignore something and say, we're not going to follow that or just throw that requirement out. And there was a lot of discussion here. They may have come to they might have pushed the envelope, let's put it this way, mm-hmm. of what is within the bounds of the rule, but that's a far cry from willfulness.
Well, I agree that's a different situation. Mm-hmm. And one of the commissioners, the dissenting commissioner, right. thought they were just merely negligent.
Mm-hmm.
But the two commissioners thought there was more there, because there were these five incidents which kept telling Kelly Maddox, your dichotomy, you're putting all of your employees on the production side was wrong. She was repeatedly told that from the OSHA inspectors, from her own consultant, and then from corporate headquarters. And if you want, Your Honor, I'll go back to the note now, mm-hmm. which is the minor servicing exemption.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this exemption applies during normal production operations, if the activity is adequately protected by the machine guarding standard. Okay, and you see that at the very end in the parentheses C subpart O.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to have adequate protection, either through LATO or through the machine guarding standard
mm-hmm.
for this exception to apply. Now, the ALJ and the commission both found that there wasn't adequate machine guarding protection.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the original memorandum transmitting the standard to Mr. McCowan told him, in order to take advantage of this exception, the minor servicing exception, the machine guarding standard has to apply. Well, it didn't apply, he knew that, but he still took advantage of the exception. So, what you have here is this original decision, which the fact finder here, the commission, the two commissioners, could reasonably make this inference mm-hmm. that this decision was just too far off base to be in good faith. And then you have Kelly Maddox coming along a couple of years later and being told by her own LATO consultant that LATO applies to these three jobs, the changing of the molds, the TAMs, setting up of the TAMs, and the changing of the equipment in the bead winders.
Right.
Her own handpicked consultant is telling her this.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the ex-director of safety at Bridgestone Firestone. He knew how tire manufacturing worked. And then you have Mr. Walker's memo that comes along and says, you know, we've been cited for LATO. Go revisit the application of LATO.
Mm-hmm.
All she finds out is that none of the jobs have changed. Mm-hmm. Nothing's changed
well,
here, so I'm not
that
really...
That gets you back to the definition. So normal production operations are exempt, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so as compared, normal production operations, you would think, as compared to servicing or maintenance, right? You go further, I know, this, and then servicing and or maintenance, which takes place during normal production operations, is covered only if, and then it's got two subparts there, right? And then it's got an exception to the exception.
Correct, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line here is nobody disagrees with this, is that you have to have adequate protection. Mm-hmm. And to have take advantage of this, the machine guarding standard has to provide adequate protection, which it didn't. McCowan knew that, and then everybody who was...
Is it possible to be in violation of the machine guarding standard, but not in violation, in other words?
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
Yes. And I mean, that was the initial determination, but then you have all these other events that provide her, Kelly Maddox, with more information. I mean, you have a man who dies in the factory. They have an investigation. And at the close of the investigation, corporate tells Kelly Maddox, we agree, let's re-examine Lotto, the application of Lotto at the factory. And she does nothing. And all these facts... it was reasonable for the fact finder here to put these all together and make an inference as to Kelly Maddox's state of mind, that she didn't really believe that initial determination was correct.
Now, why did the agency say that minor servicing activities which take place during normal production operations are not covered? And doesn't that lead to accidents, people getting killed, because the agency accepted that?
Well, I mean, you have to read a little bit farther, and the exception, especially as it's explained in the preamble, is to be very limited. I mean, there were certain kinds of...
Put aside the preamble for the moment. On the plain language of this exception, it says, minor servicing activities which take place during normal production operations are not covered if they are routine, repetitive, and integral to the use, provided that it's performed using alternative measures which provide effective protection. So that creates some confusion.
But Your Honor, I think you have to read the whole exception together, and you look at the end of the exception, and you realize that machine guarding and Lotto fit hand in glove. Where one ends, the other starts.
All I'm getting at is the term willful, I think, in the case law, and I think it's important to maintain as a high standard because of what's associated with willful, not just in this case, but in a lot of criminal and other provisions throughout the statutory landscape. So I just want to make sure we're not relaxing that standard.
I have no argument with you there on the law. Mm-hmm. And I think the question is whether these facts would allow a reasonable fact finder. We're talking about substantial evidence on this. Whether under these facts a reasonable person could have inferred that Dayton had a willful state of mind.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Stearman, you're well beyond your time. Are there any further questions?
I had ceded 5 minutes to my co-counsel. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm Andrew Roth on behalf of the Steelworkers Union. I'd like to pick up on this issue of willfulness, if I may. It is a high standard, but I don't agree, actually, it's limited to known violations of the law. There's a separate prong to the willfulness, which is plain indifference to the law.
Right. Do you equate that to willful blindness?
Exactly. And the court just issued a decision yesterday.
Yeah. Now, I'm aware of that. Okay. But that's also a high bar.
It is a high bar, but by the same...
Judge Kennedy first said when he came up with the doctrine 35 years ago.
I can see that it's a high standard, but it is a distinct and separate prong, and it is the prong that the majority of the commission felt was satisfied on the facts of this case. And I think it's interesting to sort of examine the majority and the dissent. Dayton Tire makes a lot out of the fact that there were no factual citations. My understanding is that's the common practice in commission decisions. But beyond that, this really isn't a case involving any serious factual disputes. At page 43 of the dissent says, I accept all the majority's facts, except for with one area I disagree in terms of crediting Kearney's testimony over Maddox. That was the one area from a factual standpoint where the dissent took issue with the majority. But by and large, the court goes on to say, I disagree. The sentence says, I disagree with the legal conclusion, i.e. the judgment, that these facts, these undisputed facts, rise to the level of plain indifference. I say they rise, they only constitute mere negligence. It's interesting. Dayton says at page 20 of its brief, the dissent said, at most, it was mere negligence. The dissent said there was negligence here. There was clearly violations of the standard. It was negligent. The dissent had a judgment that was different from the majority, which was, and it's a nebulous difference. I mean, none of these concepts, willful blindness, are really lend themselves to precise definitions. It's a judgment call. What level of sort of non-action rises to the level of willful blindness as opposed to negligence? And that judgment, this court made clear in the AJP case at 357 F3rd at 73, the court's role is not to substitute its judgment for that of the commission on questions of that nature. These are all expert people in the field. They have to make a judgment is what, in these kind of circumstances, based on what I know about how plants operate, what is really good faith? What should company officials do when faced with situations like this? And that's the judgment that the commission reached. And I think it certainly is well within the bounds of reason to say that on the facts of this case, there was willful blindness and not mere negligence. Now, Judge Kavanaugh, you say there was a lot of time and discussion. I don't think that's actually accurate. Maybe at the outset, McCowan invested at the outset when that determination
McCowan,
was made.
When the standard first came out, as I understood the record,
yes.
McCowan did go about a process of trying to figure out what was going on.
Yes and no. He did go through a process, but he made, when we talk about the minor servicing exception and things like that, that process related to certain of the machines. But beyond that, and with the linchpin of the company's assessment here, as the commission points out, what it hinged on was this categorical judgment. It wasn't an investigation. It's categorical judgment. These are production workers. These are service maintenance workers. And therefore, the Lotto standard doesn't apply across the board. That was the essence of the company's determination here, starting with McCowan and then continuing. Every time something came up, every time a company memo came out and said, we've been assessed a violation here, this problem has arisen, reevaluate. There's been a death. Reevaluate. After that death, according to the evidence, the company stressed, we want a reevaluation of where the company stands on this point. Every time that comes up, Maddox steps back and says, well, we've already made, she testified, that's already been determined.
Right.
These are production workers, these are servers.
And the Lotto standard did apply to the Ogden contractors, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no question that the Ogden.
Right. So, in other words, it's not like they were ignoring the Lotto standard. They said these employees are covered by the Lotto standard, and these.
They weren't ignoring, but that doesn't get them out of the soup, Your Honor.
I totally.
They said it didn't apply at all to their production workers because they are production workers. The commission, the majority of the commission, said that's too facile, that's too expedient a dichotomy. You've got to look at what these people are actually doing, not what they're labeled under a contract.
I take your point, but rhetorically you were making a broader point, and I just wanted to point out that they were classifying a certain category of people subject to the Lotto standard, the Ogden contractors, and others that were not, so it was a misclassification. Or they were under.
Yes, but one, a misclassification that one the commission found strained credulity.
Yeah.
I mean, just to make that facile, expedient determination, it's too cute, it's too clever, it's too expedient. I mean, there's obviously a cost associated with not only training, you know, having your contractor perform with Lotto, but you yourself implement these Lotto standards. I mean, the company took the convenient way out from the outset. And after admonition after admonition to reevaluate where they stood. I mean, this was a new standard.
Think the standard's crystal clear?
I don't think it's crystal clear, but what I do think is crystal clear on these facts is that the company did not, they were plainly indifferent to what, they didn't go back and look at the law with respect to this dichotomy between Ogden, that the law is not relevant to that.
That's exactly what's relevant to that.
No, man. There were clearly some functions like setup, and that were clearly unquestionably service and maintenance. I mean, there's no doubt, and the majority and the dissent agreed that it was clear that there were at least some of these functions being performed were clearly service and maintenance functions, not incidental minor.
Well, I think the dissent says that's the better reading, but it's not so clear as to determine a violation by the company as
well. Well, I think that the company actually had no, there was no way they could categorically say that there was no, and even Maddox in her testimony cited by the commission said, well, you know, there were some that were, you know, but nonetheless, even recognizing that there were some job tasks that were clearly, like setup of the machines, were clearly a service maintenance function.
So was the dissenting commissioner below willfully violating the law?
Was the, I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The dissenting commissioner, was that a willfully violating?
No, but it was a, I mean, they, you know, they, there was a respectful judgment. I think it's illustrated most clearly. It's interesting. You say there was a lots of time and discussion. There was a what the dissent trumpeted was a half an hour conversation that Maddox had with a, at some point, unclear point in time.
I was referring to McGowan and Maddox, yeah. Okay, I take your point on Maddox.
Yeah, I mean, I think the dissent found that that was not a, that that was plenty under the circumstances. That half an hour, you know, I think the dissent characterized it as, you know, picking a consultant's brain. The majority said that, in our view, in our expert judgment, that does not, that half an hour, when life and limb are at stake, when this is a serious matter that, you know, that arguably the investigation was definitive, had some, may have had some role to play in a fatality at the plant, good faith dictates that you do more than that. I mean, that is a quintessential judgment call on which reasonable minds can differ, as illustrated by them. I don't think the dissent was in willful violation of the statute, but the dissent came to a different judgment. And this court is not to substitute its judgment. If the dissent's view had prevailed, would we be able to get that reversed? I don't believe so.
And you just said good faith requires that you do more. That sounds a lot like negligence.
No. I don't. Negligence is I got too busy and I forgot to do it. I think good faith is when you've got such serious issues in front of you and you've got, you know, company officials telling you, not asking you, telling you, we want you to, in light of these things that have happened, we want you to reevaluate this whole operation. And all you do is have a half an hour meeting with a consultant or just sort of invoke this. Well, that decision's already been made. That's not a reevaluation to say that decision's already been made. This dichotomy has already been drawn. That's the antithesis of a reevaluation. And I would submit that certainly a reasonable mind could come to the conclusion that that's the antithesis of good faith that's dictated by the statute.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Roth.
May I just briefly respond, Your Honor?
Mr. Goldsmith, you can have 2 minutes.
I think that there's been some serious misstatement of the record here, and I'm not going to get into that, but I would like to say that the colloquy, Judge Kavanaugh.
I think you should.
I'm sorry?
I think you should.
Well, if you look at what McCowan, what Phil McCowan, who agreed, he was the consultant, he agreed with what Dayton Tire concluded about the applicability of that standard. That's number one. Number two, the compliance officer on whom the commission relies knew absolutely nothing. She had had 2 weeks of training on lockout tagout, knew nothing. Her boss said that. So the idea that anybody should have paid one moment's attention to what she said is completely ridiculous, in my judgment. She knew nothing, and the only inspection that she had conducted at Dayton Tire had resulted in a complete dismissal of a scores of pages of ergonomic citations. That's number one, in terms of the record. The colloquy, Judge Kavanaugh, between you and counsel for the Secretary of Labor on the standard speaks volumes about the supposed crystal clarity of that standard. You read the standard, you have to look at the exemptions, you have to look at another standard, and you have to look at that standard as it applies to each and every machine. It is
so absolutely... What about, I'm taking up part of your time here, but what about the exception to the exception, which does say that minor servicing is not covered by this standard, provided that the work is performed using alternative measures which provide effective protection. I think they place heavy reliance on the provided clause.
And that's correct. And the trial testimony in the record explains there was ample testimony from Dayton Tire witnesses about those alternative sources of protection. This is not easy. It's easy to stand here, never having been in the plant. I hesitate to say I actually tried that case a million years ago. That case was exceedingly complicated. And there were witnesses who testified, it's in the record, about exactly the alternative sources of protection that were used. And this, the Julian death, it had nothing to do with lockout tagout. He was building tires. It was an accident that he, a very experienced person, the record is replete with what happened there, a very experienced person who had actually been building a prototype machine because he knew, an hourly employee, steelworker representative employee, knew more about building tires than most people. He made a very serious mistake. A tool dropped out of his pocket and tripped a limit switch while he was building a tire. It had nothing to do with lockout tagout. That's what the investigation turned up. Not even the union took the position that had anything to do with lockout tagout. Yes, it was a death. Yes, it was tragic. It had nothing to do with the application of that standard. It is very easy to sit here and second guess the people who had to make the decisions. There is nothing wrong with starting from the proposition that we are engaged in production here. That's what we do. We do production. Just as Mr. Ross said, they do service and maintenance.
How do you respond to counsel's argument that there was no reevaluation that took place?
There was constant reevaluation on all of the occasions that Mr. Roth mentioned. There was reevaluation. It is possible to reevaluate and come out at the same place. And there was no direction that you have to change it because of the Julian sad tragedy.
As I understood his argument, it was that no reevaluation took place. It was just reference made to prior decision. That decision's already been made. Let's move on. Is that inaccurate?
That's not what the record reflects. There were memoranda, as I said, in the opening of the case. There were memoranda that went back and forth. There were discussions. But there's nothing willful about coming to the conclusion that you came to before if there's a reasonable basis for doing this. So, and there was a reasonable basis for doing so because this standard is complicated. There are multiple exceptions which apply. Setup is not so easy. Setup is not just setup. Setup is much, it differs machine to machine. It differs with the safety devices on each machine. It differs to what the machine does. It differs in terms of the energization. Because remember, the very first paragraph of the standard talks about the standards covering the servicing and maintenance of machines in which the unexpected energization or startup of the machines, et cetera, could cause injury. So the very first thing you have to look at is there a possibility? Is there a possibility, even if you think the standard might apply, that there is an unexpected energization? And there was testimony that there wasn't. There was testimony from the compliance officer who knew nothing that there was. And the testimony in the trial record makes clear that maybe she was wrong. You can disagree with an OSHA inspector. If you couldn't disagree with an OSHA inspector on the basis that they're arguing, every case is willful. That can't possibly be right. It is possible to look at a machine and have a different view as to whether it can unexpectedly energize, as to whether any other exception or modification of the standard applies, or as to whether the machine guarding standard applies or anything else. And that doesn't mean you're willful. That means you have a different view. And the people who actually know what's going on, those are the people who are running the plan. My time is...
We've been generous.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it.